You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And top of the Wednesday morning, afternoon, whatever, evening if you're in Europe or Africa, wherever you may be. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcast and commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide by Free Speech TV. More people watch or listen to the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. And we're very grateful to you for that. And welcome. A lot going on in the news today, which we are going to be covering. Joshua Holland's going to check in with us in just a few minutes with the latest from Occupy Oakland. It took up much of our show yesterday. More overnight news on that. We will be getting to that. Glenn Greenwald will be with us in a little bit. And how are school board elections now being politicized? We're going to get into that as well. First up, however, is Alex Lawson. He's the executive director of Social Security Works, the website strengthensocialsecurity.org is well worth checking out. And this is something that affects you whether you're 20 years old or 60 years old. It doesn't much matter. This is first of all, a third of all Social Security payments don't go for retirement. They go for people who are disabled literally widows, orphans, the disabled. And it can happen to anybody. One of my best friends, Michael Hutchison, broke his neck while jogging. And he's been on Social Security for a decade and a half as a consequence of that, maybe longer. So anyhow, Alex, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
The proposed super committee, the gang of 12, I call them, is working. We've had over 200 lobbyists now who have registered specifically to lobby these 12 people. And if they don't come to a conclusion and it doesn't get passed by both houses of Congress and signed by the president, then that invokes some draconian cuts. What does all this have to do with and mean to Social Security?
It's a great question, Tom. You pointed out that the super committee has been having basically endless meetings with lobbyists behind closed doors for the past weeks.
I thought they'd been meeting with each other. They've been meeting with lobbyists?
Oh, yeah. In the snarky headline of the Politico, it said, if you want to know what's happening behind the closed doors of the super committee, just ask a lobbyist. And it really has been basically an uninterrupted flow of lobbyists fighting for their peace, to protect their peace. And what we've done at the Strengthen Social Security campaign is we just released reports in all 11. There are 12 members, but two of them are from Michigan, all 11 of the super committee states that detail just how impactful Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are in terms of dollar figures in those states. But most importantly, each report also has one or two stories of real people like your friend who you mentioned who rely on these programs and who could be devastated by any cuts to Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. And these people, these real Americans, haven't been invited to the closed-door meetings of the super committee. They don't get entrance passes to make their case. So that's why what we're trying to do is really raise people's voices around the country and make sure that the super committee has to hear from everyday Americans who rely on these amazing programs that represent the best of American values.
We're talking with Alex Lawson. StrengthenSocialSecurity.org is the website for Social Security Works. Check it out. Alex, can you give us an example of, you know, just pick a state if there's one that you're familiar with off the top of your head, what the consequence, what the impact of Social Security is on that state?
Yeah. Let's just take Massachusetts. So in Massachusetts, Social Security has works for 1.14 million people, residents of Massachusetts. That is 17.4% of all residents in the state. The average benefit is around $13,000 a year. And in total, For Massachusetts, just Social Security, that represents $15 billion into the state economy. Now, when you add the $13.5 billion that Medicare brings in and the $12.5 billion that Medicaid brings in, you're talking about a massive piece of the Massachusetts economy. And these are very modest benefits going to individuals who basically will spend almost 100% of those back into the local economy.
And
these programs – sorry.
Well, I was going to say, and it's important to point out that all of this money is money that the workers originally earned in the workplace over a period of, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years in the workplace, and however many it may be. And the government has been basically holding in reserve the Social Security Trust Fund, actually earning interest on it, investing it in treasuries or, you know, cycling through there. But this is money that, the workers paid in. They're getting back out again in most cases.
You're completely right. You're completely right, and you can't make that point enough. That these are benefits that people have earned through a lifetime of hard work. These are, and if you go out and you ask Americans, they understand that in their heart, in their gut. They get that these programs are theirs. That's why poll after poll after poll shows that Democrat, independent, Republican, self-identified Tea Partiers, they all say hands off Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Okay.
It's really clear.
So Alex, you've identified the importance of this, and you've identified how intensely the Gang of 12 is being lobbied. What are the possible outcomes in terms of Social Security of the actions of the Gang of 12 on Social Security? What could happen?
So there's the Gang of 12, the Super Committee, have a very broad mandate to basically do whatever they want. But we also know that they're using ideas and policy prescriptions that have come from the different commissions that have come before them.
Like Simpson-Bowles.
So we do have exactly, like the Simpson-Bowles or the Bowles-Simpson Commission, the BS Commission, the Rivlin-Domenici Commission, and a few others. They basically, all the proposals to cut Social Security try to accomplish that goal of cutting people's benefits without telling them that they're cutting their benefits. So the one that's in vogue right now is actually called the chained CPI, and it is just a cut to people's Social Security benefits. And it would take place by cutting their cost of living adjustment.
So it's a slow, gradual cut that gets phased in over the next 20, 30 years.
It does. It actually has this one facet that I do like to highlight, because it actually hits hardest the oldest of the old, because it gets worse over time, right? It actually reduces people. The longer a person lives, the less their benefits increase.
So actually, it hits hardest the people who are just coming into Social Security.
It actually, what it does is it calculates when a person comes into Social Security, then the next year when they would get their cost of living adjustment, it would be lower. And
right.
The year after that, it would be lower.
Right.
The year after, so it actually hits, right, a person who's, say, 95 years old, who's been receiving Social Security for many years, in the future, that person's benefits would be reduced the most.
Wow.
And to really understand this, it's important for everyone to realize and think through that by that age, Social Security really is oftentimes the only source of income that a person has. Because even the best planners for their retirement oftentimes underestimate how long
you're going to live.
Exactly.
Yeah. Alex Lawson, strengthensocialsecurity.org, the website. Social Security Works. Thanks, Alex.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with Occupy Oakland and what's going on in the Occupy movement around the country. Stick around.
Welcome to U.S. Occupation. To win the hearts and minds. Defend all humankind. Tell the banks. Corporations, we're here to occupy the USA.
Okay, last night to the police, there was another violent raid at Occupy Oakland last night. Here's a quick clip of the video and audio of that. And then we're going to bring in Joshua Holland to comment on it and let us all know what's going on. We have that already? Okay, just play the audio. That's fine. Go for it. We'll just pop this down a little bit and bring in Joshua Holland. Joshua, writer with Alternet.org and senior writer and editor, in fact, with Alternet, and the author of The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy and Everything Else the Right Doesn't Want You to Know About Taxes, Jobs, and Corporate America. Alternet.org, of course, the website. Joshua, what happened last night in Oakland?
Oh, last night in Oakland was quite a hectic evening of protests. There was round after round of approaches to the plaza where Occupy Oakland had been evicted the morning before. And each time the crowd got there, they were warned, they were given an order to disperse. It was pretty Orwellian, actually. They got on these loudspeakers and said, if you do not leave immediately, we will... you'll be subject to arrest, and we will deploy chemical weapons, and you may be seriously injured in the process. And then they did just that. They deployed tear gas, flashbang grenades, which are pretty frightening up close. And
they can also damage the retina if you look at them.
I had one land maybe 2 feet away from me, and it left me shaking for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
And less than lethal projectiles. So rubber bullets are, by the way, metal bullets covered in rubber.
Right. Yeah, there has to be a certain mass for them to go flying out of the gun.
Yes. You know, the thing that I think a lot of the media misses is that after any of these incidents between, you know, clashes between protesters and police, there's a tendency to point fingers, you know, who instigated what, who provoked what. And what that misses is that long before any act of violence occurs on the street, there are various command decisions made that influence whether a crowd of protesters that we know is a volatile situation is going to release some steam, release some tension, or if their crowd control techniques tend to build tension. Last night, before any violence that I saw occurred, the police decided to block protesters from approaching any place where they wanted to go and protest. And I think that that kind of ratcheted up the tension in the crowd to a degree that at some point the police officers were a little bit thin on one line, and they were trying to basically block a whole series of side streets to keep protesters from approaching the jail where 105 people are being held, according to the National Lawyers Guild Observer on the scene.
Still being held.
And what's that?
Still being held.
As of last night, they were being held, yes. According to the National Lawyers Guild, there are some people who are charged with more serious crimes, resisting arrest, assault on an officer, a small number. The vast majority were charged with remaining on the scene of a riot, or disorderly conduct, and at some point in the next couple of days, a large number are going to be cited and released. Some will be held until they're arraigned Thursday or Friday.
Is the theory here of the police that if they just keep arresting people and holding them, eventually there won't be any more people to show up?
You know, the idea is that you do take people off the streets for a few days. I think that it's a rather counterproductive strategy. You know, I saw more people in the evening after these arrests than I had seen on Saturday, for example. So,
yeah, which was a big day.
If the idea is to, you know, suppress these protests by arresting people, I don't think that that's a very wise or far-sighted strategy.
The mayor's name is Jean. Is that a male or a female, Jean?
Jean Kwan. That's a female. And
female. Okay.
She's rather unpopular right now in Oakland. They've started a recall petition
right
just the day before yesterday. This is, I think it's important to understand that this is all occurring against a backdrop of a great deal of distrust between the mayor's office and the police department in Oakland and the community, all of which long preceded Occupy Wall Street or Occupy
sure.
Oakland.
Well, and arguably, in fact, goes back to the 70s. I mean, it's...
At least. Yeah. I would think it goes back further than that.
Yeah. read Dashiell Hammett's novels. I mean, it goes back to the 20s,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So in the minute we have left here, Joshua Holland, is this radicalizing the movement, or is it solidifying the movement? What's the net effect of this police violence?
Well, from what I could discern, speaking with protesters, it increased rather than decreased their resolve. I don't see this ending anytime soon, and that's a real question. What is the end point here? The Oakland Police Department is now guarding a piece of public space with hundreds of riot police, and I don't know how long they're going to maintain that, but the protesters have vowed to reoccupy that space as soon as they stop.
Is the police department taking the position that you can be here except not during the curfew hours overnight?
That's right. You can. Well, yesterday it was completely closed, and I imagine it's closed today, although I have not been out to Oakland today. But they say that eventually when they get it cleaned up, it will be available to protest, and I think the hours are, a police officer told me, maybe 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., like that.
Yeah, okay. Which, as we've said before, this, it seems like, our permit to protest is called the First Amendment. Joshua Holland, alternet.org. Thank you, Joshua.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Here's my take on this. You may find some success with arrests and shutdowns. They won't find success trying to kill off an idea. It just makes it stronger.
I'm trying to make some sense.
Talk media for the rest of us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Paul Ryan is out there. Paul Ryan, the guy who wants to voucherize Medicare and, basically say, hey, it's a me society, not a we society. You're on your own, buddy. The Republican from Wisconsin, probably one of the most toxic members of the House of Representatives. He gave a speech, entitled Saving the American Idea, Rejecting Fear, Envy, and the Politics of Division. He says that President Obama is trying to sow social unrest and class resentment. This is pretty amazing. The top, the reality is the increase in income since Reagan came into office. So here we're looking from 1979 till now. Yeah, Reagan, the election of 1980. So let's just, for purposes of, I always like to say, it all started with Reagan. It really, much of it started with the last 2 years of Jimmy Carter's administration, but part of that was the result of the Arab oil boycott, and part of that was part of Jimmy Carter believing Margaret Thatcher. But in any case, from 79 till today, the bottom fifth of Americans have seen their income, and these, by the way, are household incomes. And nowadays, most households have two working people in them, whereas in 1979, most households had one. So actual individual incomes have gone down in the lower quintiles. But when you look at household income, and the Republicans love to talk about that, so what the heck? Let's talk about that. Household incomes for the poorest fifth of Americans, up 16% since Reagan came into office. The middle fifth of Americans, up 25% since Reagan came into office. Now, this is over a 30-year period. The highest fifth, that's the top 20%, These would be people who are making six-figure incomes, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. They're up 95%. And the top 1%, which, as I recall, is like $387,000 plus, and includes all the millionaires and billionaires up above that, that top 1% is up 281% since Reagan came into office. Contrast that with the bottom fifth at 16%. And as again, as I pointed out, this is household income, not individual income. And maybe among the top 1%, you've got one person working. But I can tell you with the bottom 20 or 40%, many, and probably the bottom 60%, you have two people working in many of these households, and in many cases, three people working. And Paul Ryan is calling the president a, what do you call it, a class warrior. You know, Warren Buffett so nailed it when he said, you know, class warfare has been declared in this country, and my class is winning it, his class, his billionaire class. Here's what Rick Perry had to say yesterday on the Occupy Wall Street movement on Fox. Actually, it's what the crickets had to say after Perry was asked about that. Listen to this.
And Americans have to have confidence in the economy again, that they can risk their capital and have a chance to have a return on the investment. That's the only thing that's going to get this country back headed in the right direction. And bailing out, whether it's somebody on Wall Street or whether it's a big company in America, it makes no more sense than bailing out the French.
You sound like one of those Occupy Wall Streeters. Okay. What's odd, Governor, is that you...
he literally did not respond. He was like, okay, if I say yes, then that will be the headline. If I say no, then that will be the headline. And, you know, so he just, like, just let the cricket noise go. That's it. That's Rick Perry. Rick Perry is going to have some problems, I'm telling you. He's going to be voted off the island fairly soon. Speaking of which, this is what President Obama had to say about being voted off the island.
Now, have you been watching the GOP debates?
I'm going to wait until everybody's voted off the island. Once they narrow it down to one or two, I'll start paying attention.
There you go. And that was on the Jay Leno show, by the way, on the Tonight Show with Jay Leno. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Damon in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hey, Damon, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good.
I wanted to ask you, I don't know if this was in a movie that I saw or if this really happened in the 70s, but at one point the truck drivers protest something and they used their semis as a blockade.
Yeah, the Teamsters went on strike in the 70s, yeah.
Well, what do you think about doing that today, about people using their cars as blockades?
Well, I'm not, you know, I got to tell you, in the 70s, I was in my 20s and you know, Louise was having a baby and we were starting a business and I was, you know, I remember it, but I was not wildly politically active at that time. And I had been a decade earlier in my teenage years, but in the 60s. But the thing that the Teamsters were protesting at that time was the stark spike in the price of oil, as I recall, and its impact on them, combined with Jimmy Carter's having deregulated the trucking industry, which allowed the big trucking companies to basically screw the independent drivers. And so I'll have to ask, you know, next time we get James Hoffa on or something, ask him how that worked. But
yeah.
but you know, the thing was, you had a group of people who were all being hit in the pocketbook by the same thing. You had, you know, the trucking companies trying to screw them. You had an administration policy that hurt them. And you had the price of oil, you know, roughly, or gasoline or diesel fuel, you know, doubling or tripling over a period of literally a matter of a few weeks. And in fact, huge shortages. And Nixon had gone to an even odd days that you could buy oil. And, you know, there was rationing and all this other kind of stuff. So
I got.
Yeah, go ahead.
One other thing I want to say, get in before you have to. Job creators, like, that term drives me crazy because when I was younger, I went to a Lutheran school here in the area. Anyways, the job creators were the entrepreneurs that went into the bank, and the banks would loan them money, and they would create a business.
Right. Or they, or more often than not, they'd actually do it with their own, you know, just bootstrap. I mean, you know, start their business in their kitchen.
A credit card. Both my parents did that off of their own. So, anyways. All right. Well, thanks, Tom.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call. In terms of, you know, whether all Americans could just, like, start parking their cars out on the streets and things, you know, A, there's not that unified thread of this is one group that has, you know, leadership and a spokesperson, and even though it's a Democratic one, they themselves elected, that it's not there. So, frankly, I doubt that's going to happen. I think that the Occupy Wall Street, the Occupy movements around the United States and around the world are really important. Carl, listening on K-Talk, KTLK in Los Angeles. Carl, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's Carl Flowers in Irvine.
Oh, in Irvine. Thank you.
I wanted to give you a report from Irvine. We have a positive report. We've been camped in front of our city hall for about 10 days since a week ago last Saturday.
Yep.
But they wouldn't let us stay overnight, so each night we had to pack up our stuff and put it in a truck, and people stayed and walked on the sidewalk all night long to maintain our presence. And then so last night we brought a resolution to the city council to allow us to camp.
Mm-hmm.
And to our shock and delightment, the city council unanimously approved the resolution, and so we're approved to camp on the lawn in front of City Hall for at least 30 days.
Wow, that's spectacular.
And, so we're really happy about that. And then I just wanted to let people know that this Saturday at 11 o'clock, we're going to have a march to celebrate this result and also the continuing occupation. And so it's going to be at 11 o'clock and meet at the corner of Alton and Harvard in Irvine.
Great. Okay. Carl, thanks for the announcement and thanks for the good news. Great to hear from you, and I appreciate the report. Excuse me, Bobble in Phoenix. Hey, Bobble, what's up?
Hi. I just wondered if you're interested in the Romney ad that the Democrats are running here and then the Republican response.
Okay. We have about a minute. What's up?
Okay. Romney said, you know, let everything play out, run it into the ground, let it go, which means let everybody be foreclosed upon.
Right.
And so they go to the Republicans, and the guy from our Republican headquarters here said, well, no, they didn't play the sentence right after that, which is, oh, let the investors come in and buy it all up and fix it up and rent it out, which still is the same thing. It's even worse.
Right. It's yeah, let all the homeowners crash and burn so that the rich people can come in, buy up the properties at fire sale prices, and then rent them back at a profit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, also, do you think that possibly there's, you know, I am a conspiracy person, that maybe they want to turn us sort of into a feudal society where the, you know, the monarchy, the lords own everything, and the rest of us are just a bunch of...
Bobby, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to think that. I wrote an entire book about that called Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. They have been actually saying that out loud since the 60s in their writings. So, which I document in the book. So, yeah, you're onto it. You've got it. And feudalism is what it is.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Should we tax wealth and not work? How do we reorganize this society? What do we do about this 1%? Some thoughts after this.
How did Mandela get the will to surpass the everyday when injustice had him caged and trapped in every way? How did Gandhi ever withstand the hunger strikes and all? Didn't do it to gain power or money, if I recall, it's the gift.
Take it back to mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you in our cheesy news report with the tip of the hat and many thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. In what many are hailing as a breakthrough solution to Greece's crippling debt crisis, Greece today offered to repay a bailout from the European Union nations by giving them a gigantic horse. Finance ministers from 16 EU nations awoke in Brussels this morning to find that a giant wooden horse had been wheeled into the city center overnight. The horse, measuring several stories in height, drew mixed responses from the finance ministers, many of whom said they would have preferred a cash repayment of the EU's bailout. But German Chancellor Angela Merkel said she welcomed the beautiful wooden horse, adding, what harm could it possibly do? Okay. The Oakland PD has issued a press release saying that they're not using rubber bullets. If you go over to Daily Kos, you can see the photo of the rubber bullets and of a guy hit in the face with one, called so-called fin-stabilized rubber bullets. They're fired by shotguns. I think the Oakland Police Department has a, shall we say, a bit of a credibility problem right now. It's going to be interesting to see how all of this plays out. And by the way, let me just open, you know, let me just say, you know, our lines are open. Actually, they're not. There's a bunch of people on hold right now, but you know, very, very frequently you can get through 866-987-THOM and 866-745-CONS. And if anyone from the Oakland Police Department would like to call in, I'd be pleased to put you on the air. Find out what you have to say. Tom in San Francisco. Hey, Tom. Thanks for listening to Green 960. What's up?
Well, there's a lot going on, and I've been participating, and some interesting things are emerging. As we know, one of the reasons for this movement is the sort of broken social contract that's gotten between the power of the people.
Yes.
Basically, the moneyed interests are now running our representative government, and that leaves us with very few ways to influence what's happening.
Yes.
So the General Assembly, which has emerged from these Occupy Wall Street, is a consensus-based decision-making process without leadership. That's number one that's emerging.
Right, that's
number
classical
two,
political anarchy. I mean that as a compliment in a positive sense.
Right, because it allows us to exercise something which most of us has forgotten how to use, which is the power of the people from which the Constitution works.
It arguably is the purest of forms of pure democracy.
And it's the only one we have left now, because the level of manufactured consent that's going on usurps the what you call the social contract now, as you've well documented in your work.
Yep.
One of the things that's coming out along with the General Assembly is a way to build a way forward together and reestablish the power of the people, and it's called a renewal group. And what a renewal group does is you get together with your neighbors, and everybody's welcome. Everyone in the 99%, even the 1%, to sit down and have basically a small General Assembly where you discuss how do we reassert our power? What do we need to do? And some of the things that are coming up are people need to participate in their local chapters of different political parties. They need to run for office. We need to, again, establish the power of the people. And I sent you a long document in your email today that outlines this emerging phenomenon. I'd love for you to interview that author at some point. But for now, the point is we are taking the power of the people in through nonviolent means. And remember, there are so many of us.
Okay.
We cannot be stopped. Yep. Bullets cannot stop us.
Well said, Tom. Odds are, if you send it to me by email, my spam filter caught it and I haven't seen it. Best is to post it on the daily blog over at TomHartman.com, because I do read those.
I'll do that.
Pretty much anything that's got political words in it doesn't make it past my spam filter unless it's, you know, just a few people who are whitelisted, but because I just get so much, you know, I get 400 or 500 emails a day. It's the only way to make it manageable. But in any case, I'm with you, and I think it's a great idea. And it's basically, you know, get together with your neighbors, invite them over for a coffee party. You could even call it a tea party.
No, you call it a renewal group.
A renewal group. Okay, that's all the better.
Because we're renewing the country.
There you go. Excellent. Excellent. Very, very well said. Thank you very much, Nora in Minneapolis. Hey, Nora, what's up?
Oh, hi there, Tom. I was calling because I consider the tar sands pipeline to be the hugest issue in our area. And today I wanted to share with you and your listeners that Clyde Belcourt is having a guest do a teach-in at Occupy Minnesota, and it is Terry Smith, the former chairman of Roseau River Band in Manitoba, and he's been providing a lot of resistance in that area for this pipeline that they're trying to put through with the tar sands. And so today at 5 p.m., the so-called formerly known as Government Plaza, now called People's Plaza, downtown Minneapolis, 5 p.m. today.
Uh-huh. Okay, great. Thank you very much for that, Nora.
Could I add one more issue?
If it's very quick, I'd like to get another caller in here before the end of the hour.
Okay, this is really quick. There's a federal law still on the books that we're very disturbed about that states it is a crime for a Dakota person to return to the state of Minnesota. We want to get it changed. It's ugly. I want to get my senator on it, Al Franken's on the Indian Affairs Committee.
Good.
We don't like it. I was at the We Are One conference. It got brought up and reaffirmed that someone tried to change it, and it was denied, and now it's still a federal law. We don't like it. It makes Minnesota look like...
This is a terrible remnant of 400 years of racism in North America. Nora, thank you very much for that and for mentioning that. Desmond in Brooklyn. Hey, Desmond, we got a minute left. It's yours. What's up?
I'm sorry that I got caught at the end. This is the thing. I live in Brooklyn, New York, where Mayor Bloomberg has been the mayor. He's in his third term, and he changed the laws to do that. He's a plutocrat. He has been systematically reducing the unionized forces in the city, particularly the police departments. Now with Occupy Wall Street, there has been a tremendous reduction in community policing to take police forces and place them down in the Wall Street area. The subsequent result of that has been increased anarchy in the inner cities. He has also funded or worked to fund other plutocrats in doing the stadium for the Nets ball team. Mm. There were promises of 1,200 jobs, and no jobs or hardly any jobs have materialized. If those jobs were to be placed in the inner city, particularly Brooklyn and Queens, there would be subsequent reduction in gang violence, gangs forming.
You're absolutely right. Desmond, you are absolutely right. As Franklin Roosevelt famously said, the best welfare program is a job. Up next, Emily Sirota on how to battle corporate money in local elections.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Y'all know that one of the main calls to action of this program, you know, I end every show every day with tag, you're it, get out there, get active. Now these days I'm throwing in occupy something. But one of the main calls to action of this program historically has been to participate in the political process. We need an inside and outside form of activism. On the outside, organizing in grassroots groups, building a grassroots infrastructure. On the inside, getting in, whether it's running for political office or, you know, whatever. And I've pointed out over and over again, the number of people that you'll find in the United States House of Representatives, the United States Senate, who, and as president, in fact, Lyndon Johnson comes to mind immediately, who literally started by running for the school board. Not only are these important offices, school board offices, because they define education policy, they shape the future of our nation, but they are also great political starting points. And I have no idea if Emily Sirota has higher office aspirations or not, but she is running for school board in Denver, Colorado right now. She's a social worker, community organizer. Sirota for Sirota 4 for schools.com. But I can tell you whether Emily plans on having higher office or not, the Republicans have known this for a long, long, long time. And they work really hard to get their rising political stars into local community levels like school boards. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
And thanks for joining us. The mom of 10-month-old Isaac, a social worker, community organizer with a degree from the University of Denver. I saw a clip that your husband, my colleague and friend David Sirota, sent to me of the local TV show, a TV station, about your candidacy. And they basically portrayed you as being opposed to school reform. Tell me what's going on here.
Well, you know, I think education policy is really complicated. And unfortunately, there is now a media narrative in our mainstream media that here in Denver that has drawn a line in the sand. You're either for reform or you're against reform. But I don't know anyone out there. I've not met anyone yet who said we need to keep doing the same thing that will continue to keep our graduation rates at 50%.
Right.
I mean, we all think that we need to do things differently. I just happen to have a different brand of reform than my opponent.
Well, and hasn't that word reform been captured, been Frank Luntzized by the people on the right as really code language for voucherized schools, privatized schools, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, that absolutely is at play there. there are very active interests getting involved in school board races all across the country because, you know, folks see dollar signs out there. Wall Street hedge funders have been very involved in this corporate reform movement nationally, and there is
education reform,
some of that at play.
You mean education reform?
Yes,
yeah.
Sorry.
And they call it education reform, and it's really just like basically privatized schools. I understand that your opponent received a $25,000 check from an oil industry CEO, $11,000 check from a healthcare industry CEO, $10,000 check from the chair of the Colorado GOP, and $10,000 from a financial executive. This is for your opponent. Why are these fat cat Republicans throwing tens of thousands of dollars into a school board race in Denver?
Well, and you should know, and your listeners should know, it's not just my opponent who received those huge checks. There is a slate of candidates who are running here in Denver who each got those giant checks. So those individuals wrote three separate checks for $26,000, $25,000, $10,000, $11,000 to three different individuals. And, you know, and we have seen it beyond Denver, but in the surrounding counties, just south of us in Douglas County, the same kind of takeover of the school board is being attempted. In Douglas County, that's where we saw a voucher program implemented. It was stopped by the courts, but, so we're seeing it happening around. And here in Denver, Republicans don't often get elected to office. So, I think these folks have chosen, you know, their next best target. And
right.
I'm an independent person. I'm not running as any part of a slate or beholden to any special interests. And so I think that's scary to folks who would like to have more control over the education policy that's set here in Denver.
Right. And I would and as I opened this segment, my personal conspiracy theory is that this goes way beyond education policy. But, you know, who knows? The voucherize, privatize, and charterize. That's basically what these guys are referring to when they say reform. What are you suggesting as the as your local Denver television station said you were the, I guess they identified you as the teachers union candidate or something like that? I mean, is that an accurate characterization? What are you suggesting should be done in Denver?
Well, I'm suggesting a more collaborative work environment where we bring all of the essential stakeholders to the table, and teachers happen to be one of those stakeholders. And so I believe that's why I have the support of our teachers, and I'm very honored to have that support. And, you know, that support came in contributions of, you know, small dollar increments of $20 or so at a time, and folks pooled together to support a candidate who they see as someone who wants to bring our educators to the table and make them a part of the discussion about how we will change education policy going forward. What I would like to see here in Denver is a return to focusing on our communities. That right now we have a very inequitable system, and there are folks out there who would like to see parents driving halfway across town to find a good school for their child. I think it's important that we invest in our communities and our neighborhoods so that no matter where a child lives in Denver, that they have access to great schools in their neighborhoods. And, you know, I'm not somebody who is completely opposed to the concept of a charter school. I think that we need to be very clear and transparent about all of the data that we are gathering and talking about, that when we're talking about results, we have to talk about who has access to schools, what are the requirements for being there. You know, in our traditional neighborhood schools, are those schools that do guarantee access to any child who walks through the door at any point in time during the year? And so those schools face challenges that we need to rise to meet, and that requires bringing attention and focus to our neighborhood schools, because, you know, parents, no matter what their socioeconomic level, they want their kids to be able to go to school in their neighborhoods. They want their kids to ride their bikes down the street and to know their neighbors. And they want a great academically challenging educational opportunity in their neighborhoods. And so that's the type of reform that I would like to bring.
Yeah, and that's great. It's solid. It's the stuff that works. We're talking with Emily Sirota. Her website's sirotaforschools.com. and about the importance of schools and this race in Denver where all this right-wing money is coming in. Emily, we have less than a minute left. Is there a point that you'd like to make or something that I've missed in our conversation that you want to share with our viewers and listeners?
I just like to encourage everybody to go out there and get involved at these on these races at the very local level, because this is where you as an individual can have a huge impact on policies that affect your communities at the very, very basic local level. And you can have a tremendous amount of influence on these smaller races. And we have seen a huge outpouring of support of volunteers from across the community and across the country. People are watching what's happening now in this race where these private interests are trying to buy our education policy, and the average person is standing up to say, no, we won't let that happen. And so I encourage everybody out there to get involved and get active, because you can have a huge impact at the local level.
Amen. Sirota for schools, forschools.com. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, John Nichols. Let's take this to a larger frame. What does, how does this affect the entire nation, frankly, the challenge that Emily's facing in Denver?
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard, hoping to pass.
Well, we were just talking with Emily Sirota. Sirota for... Let me get this right. I want to be sure to say it right. It was Sirota for schools. .com, her website, and who is running for a school board position in Denver. And while this particular, oddly enough, this particular school board race, Emily is one of three candidates who big conservative Republican money is coming in to oppose, is happening. This is also happening all over the country, although in the case of Denver, George W. Bush just stepped into this. This is incredible. John Nichols is on the line, the Washington reporter for The Nation, thenation.com. John, welcome back to the program.
It's always good to be with you, Tom.
Thanks. It's always great having you on, John. George W. Bush shows up in Denver?
Sure. Denver is obviously one of the central fights in the future of public education, and the players in this fight extend across many, many lines. And so you're seeing all the pieces come together in this final week before the November 1 election. You've talked about the money and also, frankly, some incredibly poor media coverage that sort of sees big money contributors, out-of-town influence as somehow noble and quote-unquote reform-oriented,
right,
whereas local teachers are somehow a problem.
Well, they're union stooges or something
exactly.
Like that. I mean,
you see all that.
Yeah.
And then coming as an overlay on it is this very highbrow discussion playing out right on the eve of the election with George W. Bush flying in to appear with the mayor of the city, titularly a Democrat, but a Democrat who has endorsed the conservatives in all these races, to talk about the importance of school reform, the importance of testing and standards as defined by these folks.
Well, he's got a brother who makes a lot of money in this business.
Well, and Bush himself has set up one of his big projects post-presidency is a education foundation that puts down a heavy overlay in favor of essentially these quote-unquote school reforms around
which
the
is
country.
Basically privatizing and voucherizing schools
and charter schools.
They're
very open. Some of these folks are open to keeping a public school setting in play, as long as you can create sort of a rigid charter school setup that allows, frankly, for a resegregation or at least a class-based division of the schools. It's a way
right.
to get around basically all of the federal legislation of the last 50
now,
years.
One of the points that I made in my setup with Emily, and I probably should have saved it for now because I have no idea what her future political plans are. I didn't want to ask her. I believe that she's just totally in this for the school board. But the first political office I believe that Lyndon Johnson ever ran for was school board. He used to be a teacher.
School board is a starting point for a lot of politics.
Oh yeah, a lot of people in this town who are in Congress started out at the school board, And could that be the reason why the Republicans are coming in and saying, you know, a potential rising star, a potential progressive rising star, let's squash them like a bug. Or maybe they don't even care about squashing progressives like a bug. They're trying to get their Republican rising stars into elected office so they can start climbing the ladder.
Well, I think that's always been a part of it. But this is, I'm going to suggest to you, Tom, this is bigger. This is part of something very closely related to stuff you and I have talked about a lot this year. And that is a full court press to disempower unions in the public sector, unions as a political force at the school level, at the county level, at the state level, at the national level. And many of the same players who are huge funders of Governor Scott Walker's initiatives in Wisconsin, Governor John Kasich's initiatives in Ohio, are also playing hard and heavy in school board races, not just in Denver, although we've been able to highlight this Denver one in a big way, but also in North Carolina, in Louisiana, around the country. There is a clear press on this. And one of the reasons is that teachers have organized in almost every place in the country. Teachers are members of unions. Those unions are key players in maintaining public education and the public sphere, and in entering into the political discourse on behalf of a lot of progressive ideas.
Right.
But I think it goes beyond an individual race or an individual candidate. It is really part and parcel of a broad national initiative that we're seeing play out, I think, in more ways this year than we've ever seen before, and with a explicit purpose. And that purpose is to make sure that the public sector is diminished, and that those forces that traditionally have defended public schools, public services, are weakened both structurally and politically, so that they can't play in the future.
John, just to wrap up this segment here, I'm curious your thoughts on the violence of the Occupy Oakland movement. Night before last, the police literally tear gassed children. Last night, it sounded and looked like a war there. They were firing rubber bullets at people. We've got pictures of people who have been bloodied by them. How can anyone stand up to that kind of police violence?
Well, people shouldn't have to. Moms with kids should, you know, take their kids to safety. That's as anyone would expect. But there should be a stand-up, and I've seen some folks do it. I'm particularly impressed with California Nurses Association, National Nurses United, a very progressive independent union now only recently associated with the AFL. They have stood up vocally and aggressively to defend the Occupy movements in not just Oakland, where there's been, you know, some really unbelievable
police riots,
police action, but also in Chicago and cities across this country. So there are institutional voices and forces stepping up, and that's really important. No mom with a kid should have to, or dad with a kid should have to fight this fight alone.
Well, no American should have to.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, the First Amendment says that we have the right to peaceably assemble and petition our government for redress of grievances. That's what's
exactly
going on.
It's a very important thing, but unions and political players have to step up.
Amen.
So that individuals aren't left alone out there.
Amen. John Nichols, TheNation.com. Thanks, John.
Thanks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Governor Brown, could he stop the police actions? And how about taxing wealth instead of income?
Is our children learning? As yesterday's positive report card shows, children do learn when standards are high and results are measured.
Yes, children do learn. Is our children learning? Yes. Oh, George, you're so smart.
Stupid people.
It's a stupid people alert. No, and I'm not referring to George W. Bush. This was a Facebook page. This is how Jason Andrew Smith got nailed in a burglary. He broke into a house, and while he was there, he just couldn't resist. There was a computer turned on. He couldn't resist bringing up his own Facebook page. And, of course, he had to log into it with his own secret password in order to really see everything, and he did. And he burgled the house, and then he left, and he forgot to close out his own Facebook page, and that's the end of the story. Yeah. Stupid People Part 2. If you go over to crooksandliars.com right now, and actually this is kind of floating all over the Internet, you will see Cokehead Conservative, Coke as in K-O-C-H, Koch brothers. Cokehead conservative filmmaker hands out bongs at Occupy Wall Street. This guy who made an anti liberals in college film, documentary, I think they call it, that I think he calls it, that is being promoted around the country by foundations like the Bradley Foundation and the DeVos family and the Koch brothers, and through Donors Trust, which is a front group for right-wing donors who don't want their names out there, that this right-wing blogger, and it's also the Cato Institute, the Koch-funded Cato Institute, is out promoting the thing very heavily, libertarian think tank. And this guy is at Occupy Wall Street in New York City handing out bongs and Che Guevara's cigarette papers in the hopes of getting somebody to presumably fill one and take a puff, and then he can, and he's got a bunch of gotcha questions that he's going to ask, and he's trying to make a documentary. It's like, this is like sad. You know, why would a guy on the right who says that he's standing up for constitutional principles be trying to entrap and trash and betray people who are exercising their First Amendment constitutional right of free assembly to petition their government for redress of grievances? I mean, what am I missing here? I can tell you what I'm missing here. You can make a lot of money if you go to work for the Koch brothers and the right-wing foundations. They will make you famous. They will get you on Fox News. They will make sure that your books become bestsellers. You will become a media star. You will have a future that is assured. If you can figure out a way to nail liberals or be a toxic enough conservative. And I just have to say, either these people are deluded or they have no soul. Or both. David in Denver. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi. Well, first thing, hooray for Emily Sirota. I voted for her.
Oh, good on you. Do you have early voting? Have you been able to vote already?
Yeah. Well, I just filled out the
absentee ballot.
Now I'll take it over to one of the voting centers tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk a little bit about what's been happening to the schools, because in not just Denver, but the whole metro area, the main problem I see is the continuing results from these charter and privatized schools. They aren't doing any better.
No, in fact, speaking as a guy who's been on the board of directors of a private school for several decades, I can tell you, and I've been watching these studies, charter schools, when you balance out the income and the economic class or status of the parents, when you balance those things out, so you're comparing apples to apples and compare charter schools to public schools, charter schools not only don't outperform public schools, but in many cases underperform them.
Underperform.
And when you look at them on a cost basis, they almost always underperform them because somebody's making some money on the school. If it's a for-profit, the for-profit schools almost always underperform them.
And, well, the damage that's done to the public schools, my wife and I have had to tutor our grandchild in math because the way they're teaching her just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So it's not a good thing.
Yeah, the problem is the public schools end up with larger and larger classrooms, teachers having to do more and more, you know, and frankly dealing with more and more unruly kids, because the charter schools and the private schools won't take those kids, and so the public schools become dumping grounds, which sets up a vicious cycle. It sets up a self-fulfilling prophecy. You've identified it perfectly, David. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Miles in Denver. Hey, Miles.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's up?
I just wanted to comment on one thing. You know, it pains me as a lifelong Democrat to hear the arguments going on in Denver.
Because you have a Democratic mayor who is supporting the conservative members of the people running for school board?
I think what we have actually, so it's not a Republican-Democrat race. It's a Democrat-Democrat race. There are no Republicans in this race whatsoever. But historically, if you go back to the primary between Romanoff and Michael Bennett, I think what you have playing out here is kind of a war within the parties. So there's Michael Bennett Democrats, which I would consider myself one, and there are Andrew Romanoff Democrats, of which I think Emily Sirota would consider herself. And it's unfortunate that we don't have a big enough tent that when the discussions arise around education, that Democrats get labeled as Republicans. Mm-hmm. This is not a Republican race. This is a Democrat-Democrat race.
Right. Did I label any of these people as Republicans?
No, I think Emily has, though. I know when she was recently on MSNBC, she talked about, you know, Republican influence here. And
well, what
no
you're
means,
seeing is that these donors, these very large donors who are bringing money into this case, CEO Henry Gordon of the oil industry, CEO Kent Thierry of the healthcare industry, GOP Chair Bruce Benson. These people are Republicans, and they're the ones who are supporting her opponent. So I think it's legitimate to say that you've got some fat cat Republicans who are trying to influence this race. This is a nonpartisan race, the school board race.
Now, I would give you credit that there certainly are some Republicans that have given money to the races, but a lot of the talk has been about out-of-state contributions, for which Emily has gotten about 35% of her money out of state. You know, I think it's a matter of, you know, where do we draw the line? And if we want to look at conservative philosophies, a lot of the candidates that are running on the Democratic side actually have voucher proponents behind them, like a man named Arturo Jimenez, who has voucher proponents that are clearly on his website.
Yeah. There are Democrats who are, you're right, Miles. There are Democrats who are proposing this, and you say it's a shame there's not, you know, a big enough tent in the Democratic Party. I'd say that maybe the tent is, I don't want to say the tent's too big, but it is a pretty big tent. Jeff in Colorado Springs, Colorado. It's Colorado hour here. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was just reading something. Well, I saw the president on television today addressing someone up here at CU talking about student loans, as long as we're talking about education.
Yep.
And I just had a Mephistophelian thought. Perhaps the bankers could bundle those student loans. Apparently, they're holding more debt than credit card holders.
Yeah, it will reach that point sometime in the next few months, yes.
Okay. I have a Mephistophelian idea here. Maybe the
As in Mephistopheles, you mean?
Yes,
okay.
Indeed.
All right.
Perhaps the banksters could bundle student loans and sell them as derivatives.
They may already be doing it. You know, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they're already doing it. In fact, I would be astounded if they're not doing it. But, Jeff, that's something we should probably look into. But thank you for the call. Fortunately, the president has identified this situation. And in the next hour, I want to get a little bit into what Thomas Jefferson had to say about education. And by the way, it's in mentioning the Occupy movement last night, not only was there a police riot, not only were there police actions in Oakland, but there were also police actions in Atlanta, Sacramento, and Baltimore, as Benedict points out in our chat room. Let us leave no movement behind here. Nancy in Oakland, Illinois. Hey, Nancy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was wondering, can't Governor Brown do anything about this?
Can in California, Governor?
Right. Tell them in Oakland that they, you know, I mean, he's supposed to be a Democrat, a liberal, whatever.
Yeah, he's a good guy. My guess is that if he tried to insert himself into a local event like that, it would blow up in his face, both politically and probably legally. This really is up to the city and the mayor. That's their police department. So,
why was Kennedy, the president, able to go and stand up against, what's his name that got shot in Alabama?
George Wallace. Because at that point in time, the Supreme Court had ruled in 1954 in Brown versus Board of Education, and that segregation was illegal. And so he had the force of law behind him, federal law, and he was simply trying to enforce not just the Supreme Court ruling, but also legislation that have been passed to support that Supreme Court ruling at a federal level.
Can the governor stand up and say, you know, this is against the Constitution of the United States?
Well, that's up to Jerry Brown. I'm not condemning him and I'm not defending him. I have no idea what Jerry Brown's position on this is, and I don't live in California. It might already be out there, and I just don't know, so I'm not going to comment on that. But I frankly think every Democrat, every American should be supporting the Occupy movements.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll have more of your calls and thoughts, and we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service to find out what's going on in the world here in just a second. 45 minutes past the hour. Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner with us, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, which, by the way, is the website that Ellen put up for her birthday. You're becoming an old goat.
I am an old goat.
You're not an old goat in my mind, Ellen. And Ellen put up for her birthday where you can participate with her in helping to fund communities in war-ravaged, now independent nation, Southern Sudan, one of the poorest places in the world and one of the toughest.
And you can give a partial goat.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to say there's a guy here. I don't have his name and I'm not sure he wants it. He sent me, clearly on a fixed income, $2.88. That meant as much to us as somebody that sends us $1,000, because it was really from his heart.
Amen.
From this program.
Yep. Oh, that's great. Thank you, Ellen. So what's up?
Okay. Well, economic news, not so bad. New home sales up 5.7% in September. Durable goods sales was down 0.8%, but they think that's because of the airplanes. There are not so many orders for airplanes, so that drove down that. Yesterday, the Foreign Affairs Committee heard from the State Department. Today they heard from the Defense Department about this. They said that the Africa deployment is going to be quite limited, and they want to teach people how to operate in difficult jungle terrain. That is actually more towards the Congo, and then, of course,
this is the 150 soldiers we're sending into Africa to gather intelligence
countries.
Or support.
They're basically gathering intelligence. And, of course, up near where you and I were, it's not jungle. It's very flat.
Yeah, it's scrub desert.
Desert land. Yeah. So they spoke of that, and they said that they want to dismantle the Lord's Resistance Army. That's their major thing. So that's 2 days in a row.
Right, which has nothing to do with Jesus Christ. It has to do with a crazy guy who says that he's the Lord.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and he's got a whole bunch of
and he kidnaps
kids.
People.
He kidnaps children for murder and, to turn them into killers, yeah.
NATO.
Although Rush Limbaugh thought he was, you heard this whole thing?
No, I didn't.
Limbaugh, when this first came out, Limbaugh went off on this going, here's Obama going into Muslim nations trying to kill people who are in the Lord's Resistance Army, Christians, people who are supportive of the Lord. And I'm sure he corrected himself.
Right.
He was so widely ridiculed. Oh,
right.
Louise has yelled he never did. I honestly don't know. I don't listen to his show,
okay.
But I saw that.
NATO says that they are not going to end the bombing campaign. It doesn't mean that they're bombing, but they're officially not ending
bombing
it.
Bombing campaign of what?
Libya.
Okay.
Because they haven't spoken to anybody at this point about it in terms of their other NATO partners. But so officially they're not ending it, but they're not bombing.
Right. Okay.
So, okay, Joe the Plumber has announced his house run officially in Ohio. He's going to be in Marcy Kaptur's area. He said he, even though he's filing as a Republican, he said, but God, that does not encompass who I am since I'm going to represent all Americans. How about all the people in his district?
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
You know, did you know our Joe the Plumber story?
No.
We had him on this show.
Oh, really?
And he had just come back from Israel on behalf of Pajamas Media. And it's the one and only time in the entire history of this show that a guest has said, you must sign this before I come on the air with you. And what I had to sign said that I would only ask him questions about his area of expertise, which he intended to mean the fact that he'd just come back from Israel. So I had him on for 12 minutes. And for
nothing
12
about
minutes,
plumbing?
That's all I asked him. I asked him nothing but plumbing questions. And he had great plumbing answers. So It was hysterical. It was just hysterical.
That's the funniest thing. Oh, my gosh. You have to put that up on your website if it's not already. And we'll put it up on ours. We'll link to it. Okay. Well, it's interesting. Today, as you know, the president was in Colorado talking about loan reform. Yesterday, the White House announced what they were going to do with student loan reform. But Senator Lamar Alexander said that he wants to change the different ways that of the cost of attending college. Well, what do you suppose he wants to do? He wants to reduce health care costs and mandates that are soaking up state dollars in the past that have gone to support public colleges and universities. So he's making a direct correlation between health care costs and tuitions at public colleges.
So wait a minute. He's saying that in order to reduce tuition, we're going to let sick people die?
Or not give them insurance? Or. That's right.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what happens when people don't get insurance.
It's a pretty wild correlation. I thought it was one of the most wild ones I've ever seen.
It's insane.
Okay, Paul Ryan, another Republican. I love to report what Republicans are doing. He accused Obama today of sowing social unrest as he's going around the country promoting his jobs bill. He spoke right next door to where we are sitting right now at the Heritage Foundation. He said instead of working of equality of outcome, Paul Ryan suggested equality of opportunity by reforming the tax code instead of raising taxes on the rich.
Amazing. Was he in that auditorium where I debated Bill Bennett?
Yes, he was exactly like right 500 feet from where we are.
Right, and was it a hand-picked audience or was it open to the public?
No, actually, they opened it to the public, but, I mean, how many times have you gone to the Heritage Foundation to... We send our press, we send our staff there, but...
Yeah, but nobody told Code Pink. Apparently.
Exactly. Oh, by the way, I know I just always like to give the update on the great state of Ohio. Obama is leading a little bit, but not quite 50%. But Cousin Josh, who is probably running against Sherrod Brown, my cousin by marriage, Josh Mandel, it looks like Sherrod is so far beating him 49-34% in polls.
I'm sorry to hear about your... About your Republican cousin.
Yeah, I do have this report. Okay, a couple other interesting things. Janet Napolitano today, she was defending the administration policies, despite the fact that, of course, under the Obama administration, they've deported more illegal aliens than certainly President Bush did.
Right.
And as I think I reminded you, that Tony Snow said to me that the reason he stayed on, even though he was sick, was to help Bush with his immigration policies, which was frankly more liberal in some respects than Obama. But she said, look, we have, you can't deport 11 million people. We've deported 396,906 individuals this year. And she said that we are looking for people who have violated the immigration system in detention. They're criminals, repeat offenders, or crossed the borders more recently. And as she said, 90% of the people that they have deported fall into the immigration ICE policies.
Interesting.
So that's interesting. And one last thing, it looks like they are primed, according to National Journal, to do some legalization of internet gambling. I know some guy that's been in jail for years. He wanted us to legalize it and collect the taxes. The United States is saying they're losing a lot of income.
Ellen Ratner, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back with Glenn Greenwald.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Back on October 28th, 1813, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams got into a bit of a fight in by mail, in which Jefferson was suggesting that we should have free public education. He had just funded and founded the University of Virginia as the nation's first free college, which would produce what he referred to as a natural aristocracy, regardless of wealth. In fact, he went on to say at some length that we need not rely upon the rich for our government. In fact, he said the artificial aristocracy is a mischievous ingredient in government, and provisions should be made to prevent its ascendancy of an aristocracy founded on wealth and birth, either without virtue or talents, and proposed free public education, college education, as a way to bring about this natural aristocracy. John Adams, on the other hand, said, no, the Senate should be the place of aristocracy, and it should be defined by money. That battle went on for some years until Jefferson died, and it continues. It's one of the defining battles of America. Are we going to have an Occupy Wall Street movement, a 99% movement, or are we going to have an aristocracy? And increasingly, we have the aristocracy. Glenn Greenwald, a columnist with Salon.com, former constitutional law and civil rights litigator in New York, the author of three books, including his latest, With Liberty and Justice for Some, is with us. Glenn, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Salon.com/opinion/Greenwald, by the way, the website. America's two-tiered justice system. You write, it's worth asking, why now? In other words, the Occupy Wall Street movement, this populist revolt, and in fact, I would toss the grassroots level of the Tea Party into that, and frankly, all the people who showed up in 2008 who had never been involved in politics to get Obama elected into it. Isn't this a populist moment? And if so, why?
I agree entirely with you. I think that the 2008 Obama campaign was the first spark of this populist movement, this idea that the people of the country could take back the controls of government and power from this sliver of corporate power that controls and owns it. And once there was a quick realization that the Obama election, the Obama presidency, would not bring about that kind of change, then it got channeled elsewhere, first into the Tea Party and anger at Obama for being a symbol of and an ally of that corporate power. And now I think you see it with Occupy Wall Street as well. And for me, you know, the question has been asked over and over, well, what has prompted these protests and what are they really complaining about? And some people have suggested that what has motivated it is this growing, this vast income and wealth inequality. And I don't really think that's really the motivating factor, because we've had income and wealth inequality at extreme levels for several decades now, growing rapidly for several decades. And I think Americans have been inculcated to accept the idea that we can have wealth and income inequality and probably even should. I think what has changed is the perception that those inequalities are legitimate. There's a perception now instead that they are illegitimate, and the reason they're illegitimate is because we no longer all are subjected to a common set of rules called law that make those outcome inequalities fair and legitimate, but instead there's a small sliver that is exempt from the rule of law, while the rest of us are subjected to one of the world's harshest systems of punishment for even trivial transgressions.
There was a rather obscure, as I recall, Norwegian anthropologist back in the 50s who, if my recollections are correct, it's been years since I read this stuff, who suggested that the reason why there are some countries in the world where people are just dirt poor and they never revolt, and there are other countries where people actually have it fairly good and yet they do revolt, is that what defines a revolution is not the difference between wealth and poverty, or even how horrible life is, because life can get pretty horrible and people don't revolt. What defines revolution is when the gap between the expectation of what should be, what people feel like they've been promised, when the gap between expectation and reality hits a certain width, when that gap gets far enough apart, at that point it snaps and people revolt. Whether they're people in a country with an average median income of $46,000 a year like the United States, or people in a country with an average median income of $2,000 a year. Could this be some aspect of that? And what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's a really fascinating point, actually. I mean, if you look, for example, to what happened with the Arab Spring, you could certainly apply that theory there. After all, there's not been an increase in tyranny in the Arab world in the last 2 years that would have prompted some unique backlash. I think, what has changed, the tyranny has been fairly consistent. We propped up those tyrannical governments for decades. Others have existed without our help for decades. There wasn't this great revolt. I think what most people would agree changed was the ability of citizens to communicate with one another about what they had a right to expect and demand. And through technology and social networking and greater education and global communications, they began to adjust their expectations, and the gap between their reality and expectations grew. And that's what prompted the citizen outrage and anger and protest. I think that applies perfectly there. I think it applies in the United States as well. Like I said, the Americans believe, by and large, we've been inculcated forever in the idea that free market capitalism is a superior system, and that in that system, a small number of people are going to be very wealthy and the rest of us are going to not be very wealthy. We have had all sorts of cliches invented about why we should be happy with that situation. Ronald Reagan's rising tide lifts all boats, meaning, you know, the richer the rich get, the better off you'll be. Everything will trickle down and the like. And so I don't think that wealth inequality or income inequality by itself would be enough to trigger widespread protest. I think what has been required is a subversion of the belief, which Americans do expect, that those outcomes are going to be determined by merit and by hard work and by people producing things for the common good and then getting rich off it.
Yeah.
Instead, what they've seen is people on Wall Street, who we've always been told are these risk-taking entrepreneurial capitalists, who took lots of risks and lost everything, and instead of suffering the consequences, the government stepped in and helped them and nobody else. And I think that's what made it so glaring, that the government is on their side and no one else's. And not only that, but the ones who committed flagrant crimes have suffered no consequences. So yep. They not only are protected by the government in terms of getting benefits, but they are subjected to no rules the way the rest of us are as well. And I think that's the realization that has sparked the anger.
And apropos of the Arab Spring, just to get that done with very quickly, I would submit to you, and we can discuss it if you want, but I'd like to get back to the book, but that when Obama went over there and basically gave a tear down these dictators speech, you know, he had the temerity to stand right there on the platform with Mubarak and say, your people do not have to tolerate dictators any longer. That was one of the moments when the gap of expectations got really, really big very rapidly. But you know, that may be giving him more credit than is due. I don't know. It's just my personal take. But your book, Glenn, your new book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, the sum, in the minute we have left here, the sum is the top 1%. Is it limited just to banksters?
No, I think, you know, it's certainly obviously political elite who have done things like in Iran-Contra break the law, in the Nixon era break the law and get a pardon, and now we see worldwide torture regime, illegal spying, obstruction of justice during the Bush years. All of these are clear-cut crimes and yet have been shielded from accountability. So it's political and financial elites at exactly the same time that the elite class for the rest of us has created one of the world's largest and most merciless systems of punishment. So it's really this two-tiered track where the rule of law is fundamentally and radically different depending on who you are, and that's the opposite of what the rule of law was supposed to be.
Yeah, and it began with you point to Jerry Ford. Do you think that was a beginning point or just a high point?
Well, clearly we've always had violations of the principle of equality under the law since the founding of the Republic. What changed during the Nixon pardon was that it was the first time that these arguments about why elites should be immunized from the rule of law were explicitly advocated. And that framework, things like it's too disruptive to hold them accountable, we need to look to the future and move beyond this, that became the sort of justifying rationale each time elites
right.
are breaking the law.
And it became institutionalized. Yeah, absolutely. And it led to Jimmy Carter's election. Robert, Glenn Greenwald. Thank you, Glenn.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Glenn Greenwald, one of the great brilliant writers and minds of our time, and columnist over at Salon.com. We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour.
Whatever tomorrow brings, I'll be there with open arms and open eyes. Yeah.
20 minutes past the hour last night in numerous cities around the United States, police violence was brought to bear on people exercising their First Amendment right to peaceably assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances. One of them was in Oakland. Dr. Samsara Morgan is with us. She was tear gassed last night. She's a midwife in charge of the Oakland's Children Village at the Occupy Wall Street Oakland or Occupy Oakland area. Dr. Morgan, welcome to the program.
Hi there. How are you?
I am well. Thank you for joining us. Tell us what happened.
Well, early in the morning, about 5 o'clock in the morning, the encampment at Occupied Oakland and Oscar Grant Plaza was very, very violently assaulted by the Oakland Police Department. They came in very heavy-handedly, with a lot of force. They had a sound cannon. They used rubber bullets and tear gas on the group of people who were sleeping in their tents. I wasn't present for that, but we had a person who was in charge of keeping watch over the Children's Village, which had been established
for the children and families of the occupation, who herself was very roughly treated, and the children's village was destroyed. The tents were slashed with a sharp razor and everything confiscated. The entire encampment was pretty much, you know, dismantled. It took them less than a half an hour to come in and brutalize everyone, cart, I believe, about 105 people off to jail and to secure that area for themselves.
Yesterday we went to some lengths, and our executive producer, Sean Taylor, is no slouch when it comes to getting guests on the show that we really want. She's brilliant at it. Trying mm-hmm. to find people who had been at that event who were arrested, and we were unable to find any because they were all still being held in jail, which is unusual. I mean, typically, you know, it's an hour and you're out, particularly for a misdemeanor. But apparently there has anybody been let out of jail yet?
We just got word that the young woman that we consider our children's village guardian, Rachel Dorney, was released late yesterday evening.
Okay.
And my understanding also that people were given a very, very heavy bail. I believe it was like $10,000 to get out. And that would be prohibitive for, you know, if I had been arrested, I probably would still be sitting there because I don't think I could have come up with that.
Wow. We're talking with Dr. Samsada Morgan, who is was the midwife in charge of the Oakland's Children's Village at the Occupy Wall Street or Occupy Oakland encampment. Night before last, the massive tear gassing. Last night, again, they came in and confronted the protesters. The
tragedy
the
of it, I mean, people were attempting to regroup, and there was a General Assembly meeting called for 4 o'clock in front of the main library.
Just today?
Showed up
or yesterday,
this.
I mean?
Citizens showed up for this meeting. I was present at that meeting and spoke and took off to, you know, peacefully protest. That people were going to the police station to protest that their compatriots were being held illegally there. And, you know, one of the police responses was to, you know, tear gas this crowd full of women. I was meeting clients, people who had been their childbirth educator and you know, their mothers, pregnant women, children, families in this crowd, and tear gas was dispersed. We counted at least 6 canisters being used before we had to remove the space because we had to leave the space because I had a 10-year-old child with me at the time. So this was just it was just violent beyond description.
Yeah.
And I am appalled that this happened in the middle of the city that I love so well.
Dr. Morgan, what is the consequence of being hit with a sound cannon or a rubber bullet or tear gas for that matter?
Well, you know, I experienced tear gas for the first time myself, so now I truly consider myself an American citizen. And I have to tell you, if you want to, what I experienced firsthand was that your body wants to explode from the inside out. Your eyes turn red. You can't breathe. You can't think. And you kind of wish you would die.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the worst case of flu, plus you want to puke,
mm-hmm.
is my recollection of it. It's been a lot of years since I've experienced it, but yes.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen photos of people who were bloodied by being hit with rubber bullets.
Yeah, I saw that the police said that nobody was injured, but there are pictures going around the internet now of a gentleman who I believe is a war veteran, an Iraqi war veteran who was most definitely severely injured.
So here's a patriot who goes off, who believes his president and goes off thinking he's defending his nation to war, and he comes back and the Oakland Police Department fires a rubber bullet in his face.
Well, allow me to say that I have a personal sense of outrage that President Obama was in San Francisco last night when hell was being waged, war was being waged on the streets of Oakland against American citizens who were peacefully demonstrating and protesting.
Yes, it is absolutely time for the president to speak out on this. And I think that the pressure has to be building on him to do so because these are patriots. These movements all across the United States, these are patriots. And the top 1% who are basically just taking everything, 40% of all the income last year was taken by the top 1% of Americans. 40%. That's insane. We haven't seen numbers like that since 1928. This is your rant, not mine. Dr. Samsada Morgan, last 30 seconds, what your message for our listeners and viewers?
My message for the listeners and viewers is to please, you know, we all need to, if we believe in prayer, we should pray, and everybody needs to take appropriate nonviolent action in their communities. This is our country. It does not belong to the 1%. It belongs to the 99%. And especially on behalf of the families and babies, we need to. There are people who can't go out there actively and speak because they're doing that important work of child raising. But the rest of us have no excuse now to just sit and watch this go on. Our country depends on us.
Yep.
And if we want our country, we need to fight for it. We're a democracy.
There you go. And so tag your it. Go out and occupy something. Dr. Samsada Morgan, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Great speaking with you. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
More on this and the good, the bad, and the insanely ugly right after this. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very bentho-pelagically ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good. Former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. Even though he's retired, Justice Stevens has a lot of insight that current high court justices should be listening to. In an interview with Time magazine, Stevens went after the war on drugs and Citizens United. First on drug penalties, Stevens said, I think generally the so-called war on drugs has emphasized more severe punishment than is appropriate throughout the country. There are some instances where penalties are so disproportionate that they could well violate the Eighth Amendment. Then Stevens went after the Citizens United decision, a decision he wrote the dissent on, laying out the absurdity of the money, that is, the idea that money is speech argument, saying that, quote, if followed to its logical conclusion, that would have provided First Amendment protection to the Watergate burglars. They were financed with campaign expenditures. End of quote. So now the question is, just how do we kick Clarence Thomas off the court and put Justice Stevens back on? The bad. Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan. First, Bank of America takes $45 billion in bailout money from we the taxpayer. Then the Bank of America announces it'll start charging a $5 ATM fee on we the taxpayer because it has, quote, a right to make a profit, end quote. And now Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan wants us all to thank him and his bank. Speaking at an employee town hall meeting, Moynihan said, quote, I, like you, got a little incensed when you think about how much good all of you do, whether it's volunteer hours, charitable giving we do, serving clients and customers well, end quote. Then referring to people who criticize Bank of America, Moynihan said, quote, you ought to think a little about that before you start yelling at us. End quote. Let's see. Bank of America plays a role in crashing the entire world's economy in 2008. They gladly take a $45 billion bailout. They decide not to lend that money out to small businesses and people whose homes are underwater, and instead decide to take more money from us by hitting us with a $5 ATM fee, which disproportionately hits poor people. CEO Brian Moynihan is right. We shouldn't be yelling at Bank of America. We should be taking our money out of it and then breaking it up. And the very, very ugly Rush Limbaugh. Yesterday on his show, Limbaugh's made a pretty outrageous yet revealing comment about the Obama administration. He said, quote, we've got the most incompetent, dangerous group of people running this country in my lifetime, end quote. In his lifetime, huh? So I guess Rush was born after the George W. Bush administration that was incompetent in defending this nation from the worst terror attack in its history, that started two dangerous wars that we're still fighting, that was incompetent in handling the coming financial crisis, the financial crisis of 2008, that dangerously politicized the Justice Department, and incompetently and dangerously leaked the name of a CIA agent, to name just a few. I always thought Limbaugh had the emotional maturity of a child. Now he's just confirmed it. Man-child Rush Limbaugh. Very, very ugly. Kind of tragic, actually, when you think about it. Don't want to make it too ad hominem there. 866-987-THOM. We had a lot of reports yesterday that Albuquerque, New Mexico, was going to be confronting the police last night. Sheila in Albuquerque, what happened?
Okay, I wasn't there, but I saw the news this morning, and I had been there a couple of days ago. It was in Yale Park on the campus.
Right.
And at 10 o'clock last night, they were supposed to go away because their license had expired.
Right, their permit.
And so some of them decided they wanted to stay, I guess, and some of them, you know, were getting ready to leave, and the police showed up, and there was a big thing, big riot on both sides of the street.
Mm-hmm.
And the street that goes by the university is one of the main streets, Central.
Mm-hmm.
And people were standing in the middle of the street, and the police weren't using tear gas. They were using that other stuff that they use. And it was a mess. It was a real mess. And the thing is, we have had a lot of problems with our police in this town. In fact, they asked the city council and the Justice Department to come in because too many people have been murdered.
Mm.
You know, bad guys.
Right.
But they've been shot in the back by the police. So
yeah.
I didn't want to be down there at that time in case they showed up, which they did. And they didn't. There was no shooting or anything like that. But at 6 o'clock tonight, they're going to have a meeting at Yale Park to decide where to go from there.
Okay. 6 o'clock tonight, so, Albuquerque, New Mexico, University of New Mexico, Yale Park. Got it.
Yes,
Sheila, thank you very much. Go ahead.
It's at Central and Yale Street.
Great.
And that's where they're going to be at Yale Park, and it's on the campus.
Right. Got it. Thank you, Sheila. I appreciate that. Brian in Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Brian, what's up?
No, actually, I'm in Providence right now today. I'm going to be physically here.
Mm-hmm.
And first, I want to ask you to forgive this, Tom, because if I sound weary, I've been working 20-plus-hour days for the last 5 days. And I'm the primary organizer for the Fall River, Occupy Fall River group.
Okay, that's Fall River, Mass, right?
Yeah, Fall River, Massachusetts. Yeah. And I'm consulting in Boston and Providence.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been organizing for 40 years, waiting for this.
Yeah.
And we're setting up a new organizational methodology, for the movement out of Fall River. So we'd like you to invite you to maybe be our friend on Facebook, so you can follow the new organizational model. Because these people are young and inexperienced, and they have no guidance. They don't get it. This is we have leaders in our movement. We have millions and millions of leaders. We're not a leaderless movement. We have leaders.
Right.
Okay. They're young and idealistic, but they have no guidance or anything. That's why all the violence. So we're setting up a brand new model.
I would say all the violence is the result of the police, not the lack of leaders.
No, I agree.
And I think that leaders, emerge from things organically rather than get imposed on things. And the philosophical approach that has been used so far is the classic anarchic one. And I mean that in the positive sense of anarchy as a political system, which is the purest of democracies, where everyone has a say. Now, over time, that will probably morph into something that's more like a Greek democracy, where pretty much everyone has a say, and then eventually probably into a representative democracy,
which I'm guessing won't.
You think not?
Actually, it won't. No, because what's happened is that we're in a special epoch in history, because never before we had the ability to be able to actually have pure democracy, because of a community, an inability to communicate with one another. So that's why we chose representative democracy. But things have changed. Technology has now created the preconditions, the means of their own destruction, where we will now be able to have pure democracy. Because of the internet, we will now be able to directly vote on all the issues.
How are you going to do that, Brian, when there are people who have the ability, whether they be on the right or the left, whether they be tricksters, or just zealots who can, rig basically internet elections. I mean, we've seen this over and over when news organizations have tried to do online polls and things.
Because of advances in technology, we can counteract them. That's not a problem. Okay. But anyways,
I'm skeptical.
I just want you to understand what we believe in our movement, that you are brilliant, and that without you, our movement couldn't be a success, because I don't know if you really understand the importance of things you do, because you inspire people. Because what we've been doing, and I've been passing into Providence and Boston, and making sure everyone turns into your station.
Yeah. Brian, I appreciate your kind words and all of that, but you know, let's just cut right to the chase here. You've got a Facebook page. Let's mention it, and then I got a whole bunch of other calls here I want to get to.
No,
okay?
I've been waiting for an hour, but it was worth it.
Yeah.
You know,
what's the Facebook page?
Occupy Fall River.
Occupy Fall River. Okay, great. Brian, thank you so much for the call and for what you're doing. I mean, you know, just showing up, being out there. Carol in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hey, Tom. We finally have an Occupy Charlottesville. We tried at first to get a permit at UVA campus, and we were turned down because Goldman Sachs was coming in with a $300,000 contribution, Goldman Sachs plus several other of the investment bankers. They have the Darden School of Business, and they don't want to upset the hedge funders and the
That's
bankers.
Incredible. Because the University of Virginia was founded by Thomas Jefferson,
who threatened to pull Virginia
out of ratifying the Constitution if the First Amendment wasn't attached to it.
Yeah. So they sent us over to Robert E. Lee Park, which is a small park, but that's okay. We have about 50 people who stay there overnight,
mm-hmm.
and then we get about 150, 200 people during the day.
Right.
But they've given us limited to 3-day permits. So our permit this week is going to be up tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
We have to go back to the city council tonight and ask them to renew it. We're trying to get it renewed until Thanksgiving. I don't know if we're going to be successful.
Okay. Well, good luck on that, Carol. Keep us up to date on it. I appreciate the call. John in Rochester, Illinois. Just a minute to the break. John, a quick one.
Yeah, I just wanted to say about the coverage of the Wall Street thing that you mentioned a few days ago that that chemical bomb had gotten rolled into that
Occupy camp. Portland, Maine camp, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you said that, you know, it hadn't been covered on the mainstream media.
Well, I predicted it wouldn't be. It turns
out I haven't seen it.
Oh, yeah, I think Keith Olbermann is the only person who talked about it outside of me. You know,
okay, I haven't seen it, but I just wanted to point out that this morning on MSNBC, now just to be fair, I don't know if the guy said the protest or the protesters turned violent in Oakland.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it was a police riot. Let's call it what it was. It was a police riot. We saw, you know, those old enough to remember it saw it in 1968 in Chicago, and everybody else can read about it. Don't trust Wikipedia, but anyway, 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I say that because it seems like anytime any kind of historical event gets up there, then you know. The people from the Heritage Foundation go in and start editing it. We'll be right back.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
The hashtag OCT, as in October, OCT29, Enough is Enough Rally. It's going to be at the U.S. Capitol noon to 6 a.m. overnight and into the next day. I'm kicking off the rally at noon. Be there if you're in the nation's capital. That's this Saturday. And Free Speech TV invites citizen journalists from around the world to send in videos of actions in your community that support the 99% movement. They may end up on TV, on Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, and on hundreds of cable systems around the country. The way that you can upload it and get more information on how to upload it is to go to freespeech.org for details. So, let's see here. Jeff in Kailua, Hawaii?
Yes.
Kailua. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Well, you know, I've been dealing with the problem of overpopulation since the 1970s, and I've been looking at how it's been manifesting itself in the way we've been tearing up our earth irreparably.
Mm-hmm.
The greed has fostered that's been the forefront of trying to keep our economy going. But really, hey, guys, we got to get real. The bottom line in all this is we have too many people, and resources and structures of our government and societal nets are not going to keep up with the population
environmentally. I totally agree with you, Jeff. We are using more than half of the world's water. We're using more than half of the world's net photosynthetic output. We, you know, just the year the Declaration of Independence was signed, as the human race was using some small fraction of that, maybe 10%. I'm with you. In terms of politics, I don't think that this is a matter of population. I think this is a matter of the what's top 1% stealing everything. Pete, I'm sorry, I don't have a city for you, but I see you're in the 818 area code. Is that California?
Yeah, Sherman Oaks, which is okay. A small subsection of L.A.
Yeah, so what's up?
So after hearing about it on your show and Nicole Sandler's on the Internet, I called the Oakland Police Department
mm-hmm.
to register a strong complaint about what I heard they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke to somebody identified as Dispatcher 51, and I told her, you know, that I thought that the police were the ones acting as criminals there and that they would do well to learn lessons from L.A., which the police have been very good at, and things are going very well on both sides. And then,
but here's the thing, Pete. If I may speak in defense of the police for a moment, and I realize that's a pretty unpopular thing to do right now, but the cops are, you know, basically they do what they're told to do. Occasionally you have a renegade like, you know, Anthony Bologna in New York, you know, who walked up and just pepper sprayed people. But, you know, this was an action that was sanctioned by the mayor and the city council. It wouldn't have happened if they hadn't told the police to do it. So
I mentioned that.
That's where you should be directing your attention, is not to the police department, but to the civilian government that is telling the police department what to do and what not to do. Because I guarantee you, if the mayor and the city council had said don't do it, they couldn't have done it. They legally couldn't have done it.
Hmm.
And so it's really, you know, I mean, it's fine to call the police department and say, I think that, you know, this is a democracy. You can call the police department and, you know, within legal boundaries and say pretty much anything. And hey, I think you're misbehaving. And I think particularly when we see cases like in New York where this police officer just goes up and pepper sprays a woman who's doing nothing, you know, who's just standing there, it's appropriate to say, hey, how about an internal affairs investigation? But even that really should be going to the mayor's office, because that's where the real power is. The power in a democracy is with the elected officials. And that's what we need to be pointing to. Tom in Waterloo, Iowa. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, just thought I'd give you guys an update. Out here in Waterloo, Iowa, we are having an occupation called Occupy the Cedar Valley. We're occupying the downtown park in Cedar Falls. We've got a number of University of Northern Illinois students out there occupying the park.
Mm-hmm.
The other night we had a visit from the Tea Party Libertarians, and it just seems that, you know, the message that they gave us is that corporate accountability should not exist, and it's the people's fault if they get defrauded by the insurance companies.
So the Libertarians were not in sympathy with, you know, they don't consider themselves part of the 99%?
Well, actually, I think these people were more shrills for the insurance companies, if anything, more or less trying to shout us down as if we had no substance whatsoever.
That's kind of sad,
you
know.
Typical. Pardon me?
That's kind of sad.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was absolutely horrid. And I imagine that if we do go to a charter school program, well, I guess that it'll go from it being the teacher's fault to be in the students' fault
well,
for not
already,
getting an education.
Yeah, they're already doing that. I mean, that's the subtext of Pat Buchanan's entire book is, you know, why are inner city schools underperforming? Because they're full of minorities. You know, it's horrible, you know, what's going on. But Tom, anyhow, I digress. Cedar Valley, Occupy Cedar Valley, Iowa. Good on you, Tom. Thank you very much for the call and for the heads up on this. Mike in Lafayette, Louisiana. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I listen to your program occasionally. I get my news from a lot of different sources. I don't like to just get it from one.
Mike, we have less than a minute. It's all yours, but
okay,
to the point.
That last caller kind of dovetails in what I wanted to mention. Too much polarization, too much hate between the two ideologies. It's a two-party system. It's just wrecking us. Both sides have had power. Neither one.
What's your solution?
Anything. At some point, we have to form at least one more viable party for election.
So we'll have three parties that can hate each other and fight with each other?
No, just to get some different ideas going. I'm pro-American all the way, and for the record, I'm an independent. I never voted for either major party candidate.
Okay.
And you guys on the progressive side have a lot of good ideas. So do conservatives. So do us independents. It's time we all get together. And
I got it, Mike, and thank you very much. I'm sorry we're out of time. But check out proportional representation, instant runoff voting. Just I think you'll find something useful there. And tomorrow, yeah, tomorrow, we'll be talking more about Occupy Wall Street. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.